Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Caps went into this weekend with three games left, two against the Lightning and Bruins, two good hockey teams, and they've won both of them 4-2 on Saturday against Tampa, and then last night a very impressive 2-0 shutout win over Boston, which sets the stage for tonight's regular season finale at Philadelphia. Of the teams that are fighting for this last wild card spot, the Caps are the only ones that control their own destiny, as the phrase goes. A win and they are in if they can beat Philadelphia tonight. There are a lot of other playoff scenarios if they were to lose in overtime. Losing outright, they are out. But Craig Wyshynski, who is a longtime NHL guy and, of course, the senior NHL writer for ESPN and ESPN.com, he joins us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. Before we get to all of these different scenarios with the games tonight and then even Pittsburgh tomorrow night, why are the Caps back in this position with a chance to go to the postseason with a win tonight?
First of all, we're going to have a fine conversation as long as you don't ask me to quote from memory any of these playoff scenarios. They're extremely complicated, and I couldn't tell you half of them. It's one of the more remarkable playoff races that I think I've ever seen. They're in the thick of things. Well, one, because they just keep on grinding out these wins against good teams, like you said. I mean, I don't think a lot of us saw the Capitals schedule down the stretch and thought they'd be in this position. But then, you know, as we saw last night, Charlie Lindgren again to the rescue, as he's been all season. I have to imagine they'll run him back tonight in that critical game against the Flyers. And so, you know, they've gotten good goaltending, and they've just done enough to win some of these games down the stretch against really good teams.
Has anybody, Greg, with a negative 38 goal differential, it's the third worst in the Eastern Conference, has anybody in the history of the game ever been in this position with that negative goal differential? Do you know?
I haven't checked the specs on that, but I imagine the Capitals would be very near the top of that list as far as teams with a negative goal differential getting into the playoffs. I'd have to probably see if it existed in other playoff formats back in the day where they had to take four teams from a division and maybe that fourth team was garbage. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, we're going to have to check that. But the thing about it, you know, the goal differential is that I believe, if memory serves, is the point of demarcation and the only scenario in which the Philadelphia Flyers make the playoffs is that it would be some sort of a tie in the standings between the Caps and the Flyers. Everybody else gets cleared out because of other tie breaks or because they don't have enough points. And it would be goal differential that is a tiebreaker that would send the Flyers into the playoffs. So, you know, we joke about how are they doing this? How could they do this? You know, and their place in history. But at the end of the day, it is one of the things that could ultimately spell their demise if certain scenarios play out.
Yeah, it's an odd circumstance, and we'll get to this in a moment, but the Flyers are actually eliminated if the game goes to overtime, which would be an interesting scenario as well. Overall, year one of Spencer Carberry, from your seat, you watch the entire league. What's the view on the job that he did?
And that it's remarkable. I mean, you know, granted, look, good goaltending is going to make every coach look good in their first season, and I think he's gotten it on a lot of nights this year. But, you know, there was a lot of curiosity about how a guy who had never manned the helm of an NHL team before was going to handle a situation where you have such a strong veteran core at the heart of this team. And then, you know, you're peppering the lineup with younger players. And, you know, it all came together. I think he's done a really good job in keeping the vibes right and keeping the team focused and coaching through some adversity and obviously some roster changes. So I think for the most part, a lot of people felt that he's done a really good job.
Talking to Greg Wyshynski, senior NHL writer at ESPN. If they were to get in, and again, we'll go through some of these things here in a bit. If they were to get in, given the way that Charlie Lindgren's playing, I mean, they allowed less than 20 shots on goal last night. Second time it's happened to Boston this year, both times against the Caps. They're not going to play Boston. They would get the Rangers. But would people give them a shot at winning a series against the Rangers?
I think of some of the teams that are on the bubble right now, I would say that the Capitals would probably have the second least chance of beating the Rangers in the eyes of a lot of people. I think nobody believes the Flyers are winning a playoff series if they get in. I think that the Penguins, when you throw that core of players into a seven-game series and get some semblance of good goaltending from Alex Nedeljkovic, you know, I think the Penguins could win a playoff series, especially given the history between them and the Rangers. And I think the Red Wings are a team that plays with a lot of pace, and they're certainly getting a lot of really good performances offensively from Patrick Kane and Lucas Raymond and players like that. Do they have the goaltending? That's another question. But I think the Capitals would probably be the third choice of the four teams, but well ahead of the Flyers.
What have you made of the Alex Ovechkin second half of the season?
Relieving, maybe, would be the word I would use. I actually talked to Brian McClellan, the Caps GM, recently for a story that I did on TJ Oshie when Oshie hit his 1,000-game mark, and we were talking about Ovi earlier this season, and I'm like, you know, was there a moment when you were a little bit concerned that maybe for all the hype and all the expectation that we all have for him trying to break the Gretzky record, that maybe he had hit the wall? And McClellan said, you know, in my quiet moments, maybe there was a little bit of concern about what Alex was going to end up being for the rest of his time. But, you know, clearly picked up the goal scoring pace, clearly quieted a lot of the concerns that we had that maybe this chase would sputter out, and certainly has done yeoman's work in elevating this team and keeping it in the playoff hunt.
Tell me about the matchup tonight at Philly. You know, the atmosphere, if, you know, Philly's got the longest odds to make it, even with a win. But how do they match up against Philadelphia? Who do you like in the game tonight?
Well, it's a grind. I mean, it's a John Tortorella team that's trying to make this thing happen with the goaltending they have left after obviously Carter Hart left the team because of the Hockey Canada investigation. I mean, I expect it's going to be close and played to the margins, and it's going to be reliant again on Lindgren and the defense doing what they did against the Bruins the second time against the Flyers. But again, like when you, I hesitate to say this because of the nature of the playoff race in the Eastern Conference, but when you have a team that has its playoff fate in its hands versus a team that has to rely on a lot of math and a lot of circumstance in order to get in, you'd figure the team that's win and get in would be the one that comes out victorious. But as we've seen in this playoff race, assumptions like that have been subverted basically on a nightly basis in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, I mean, last night, Montreal, didn't they have at one point a three-goal lead or a two-goal lead against Detroit, and Detroit rallied back to win? I mean, that was nuts last night, because I think people saw Montreal with Detroit playing them twice and just assumed Detroit would get two wins. They did get the win last night, but they got to finish up with Detroit last night. All right, let's walk through it with everybody. I tried to do it at the beginning of the show. The easiest thing is, if the Caps win tonight, whether it's in regulation or it doesn't matter, 2 points tonight, they are the second wild card team. They will play the Rangers in a best of seven. Let's go to the next piece. What if they go to overtime, lose, and get a point? They're not eliminated, but what needs to happen?
I'm
asking the wrong guy.
Don't ask me scenarios. I don't have them in front of me right now. You have them in front of me, in front of you. So again, there's a number of different things going to happen. They're all
let me help you out
right now, and you can find out for yourself.
If they got a point and ended up with 90, Detroit would need to lose to Montreal, or lose in overtime to get a point, and the Caps would beat Detroit in a head-to-head because of more regulation wins. That's the first tiebreaker, right?
That's the first tiebreaker, is regulation wins. That's correct.
And then they would have to sit back if that happened and hope that Pittsburgh loses tomorrow night.
The problem for all these teams with regard to the Penguins is the worst thing that happened last night on the Eastern Conference bubble was the Islanders clinching. Yeah, they don't care. Like, they know who they're playing. They're playing Carolina. That team is going to be down to about, you know, a 6 out of 10 speed in their last game of the season, because the game means absolutely nothing to the Islanders. So if teams that are playing tonight are reliant on the Pittsburgh Penguins losing that game, I got bad news for you. They probably aren't losing that game. With what's on the line for the Penguins and what's not on the line for the Islanders.
Right, and to that end, what you kind of alluded to earlier, Philadelphia's chances are long shot. You know, they have to win outright, and then they got to hope for a lot of things to happen, like Pittsburgh lose to a team that's unmotivated tomorrow night. And look, I mentioned this earlier, if Detroit jumps out to like a 3-0 lead first period over Montreal, the Flyers could see that score, and they could be completely deflated because
correct.
They're out with the Detroit win. So,
yeah, there's going to be scoreboard watching for the Flyers as well. And again, like, their scenario, their path to get in involves the decks basically being cleared of everyone else except for the Capitals, and then they beat the Capitals on goal differential. So that's the fifth tiebreaker. That's where we are right now with the Flyers. So again, when we talk about motivation, when we talk about winner get in versus needing, you know, another solar eclipse to happen to basically get into the playoffs, like, you got to believe that the Capitals are going to be the more motivated team tonight. And by the way, let's not sugarcoat it, man. If the Flyers end up losing a playoff spot by a point, this entire season has been a waste. That's still a team that's rebuilding. If they get in, great. Playoff revenue, you never know how things go when you get into the tournament. But if you fall short by a point, all you've done is completely screw your draft lottery odds, and it's been for nothing. So it's kind of a melancholy night for the Flyers overall, I think.
But didn't they completely fall apart basically over the last 3 weeks to a month, to the month of? I mean, they were solidly in a month ago.
Yeah, and in the last few weeks, we've seen, you know, I've been comparing it to like a jockey in the Kentucky Derby that knows his horse is starting to slow down. Like, Tortorella's been giving him the whip for the last 3 weeks, you know, benching captains and doing everything he possibly can to squeeze the playoff berth out of this team. Because although I don't think he really cares about the draft lottery, I think he inherently knows that, you know, his success is going to be graded on whether or not they make the playoffs. And if they don't, then all they've done is kind of set back their rebuild a little bit. But I do think he's safe. He's got a contract that runs two more seasons at $4 million per. So even though he wasn't Briere and Keith Jones is higher, I think he's going to be. I think he'll probably last another season there.
All right, last one, because I know you got to go. Heading into this postseason, Are the Rangers a better bet to go a long way than the Bruins were last year?
Yeah, because I think they have a cleaner road ahead of them than the Bruins. So the Bruins, obviously, we didn't know how good the Panthers were. And then if they get passed through that series, they would have played a pretty good hockey team, too, I think, in Toronto, and who knows there. In the Rangers' case, like I think they probably beat whoever comes out of the eighth seed, or the second wild card, rather, in the Eastern Conference. And then, you know, I think the Islanders-Carolina series is going to be a grind. I still think Carolina finds a way to advance like they did a couple of years ago against the Islanders. But, like, at the end of the day, you know, you could see the Islanders maybe pull an upset, and then, you know, the Rangers-Islanders series, a rivalry series, but one I think the Rangers could win. So I think the path is a little bit cleaner for them than it was the Bruins last year. But at the end of the day, like, they're still a team that's going to have to figure out a way to win at 5-on-5 and not rely overly on their special teams, their goaltending to win, because that's not a formula for success in the playoffs.
Great job. I appreciate your availability. Check in with me if you need any of the playoff stuff explained. I'll talk to you later. Thanks, Greg.
I did not get into this to do math. You know that. You know that, Kevin.
Greg Wyshynski, everybody. At Wyshynski on X on Twitter, Wyshynski. He's really good, always has been. Senior NHL writer at ESPN. That last scenario I was not familiar with. So, if the Flyers win tonight, all right, and win in regulation against the Caps, Pittsburgh loses tomorrow night, the Red Wings lose tonight, then somehow I guess it comes down to Caps, Flyers, and Red Wings, and the Flyers would advance because of goal differential. Yeah, the Caps, for those that haven't followed it, they've got the third worst goal differential in the entirety of the Eastern Conference. It would be one of the highest negative goal differentials probably in NHL postseason history if they make it. Exciting game, though, tonight. Caps know what they have to do. They just got to win. Win the game any way, and they are in to the playoffs to face a New York Rangers team that is excellent, but still would love to see it. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We are also free and live on the Odyssey app.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
So yesterday and today, the Washington Commanders made two hires. Today they hired a consumer affairs person. His name is Kirtan Mehta. He's the VP of Public Affairs. He replaces Joe Maloney, who was there for a while. Joe, one of the real sharp people and good people in the organization for years. Mehta is the team's VP of Public Affairs. So he's going to be a guy that's focused a lot on the stadium, but also, you know, dealing with league officials, community organizations, sponsors, fans, etc. That's a business side of the building hire. Someone who would report to Jason Wright, I would assume, the team president. Yesterday's hire was more interesting because, in part, the reaction it got from people around the league. Washington hired yesterday a gentleman by the name of Dave Guardi. Dave is taking the position as senior vice president of football initiatives. And he does that after spending two decades plus in the NFL league office in New York. He held the role of senior vice president of football operations for the league for 10 years. He was the senior VP of labor relations and football administration, started back in 2003. And he took the job here as senior VP of football initiatives. Now, before I get to what they're saying his job description will be here, let me just tell you that people around the league were really impressed. Multiple people that cover the league said that Dave has been one of the most impressive people in the league office for years, and that this was, for Washington, a hire that shows that they now as an organization, quote, get it, closed quote. That came from Jim Nagy, the head of the Senior Bowl. A lot of people around the league very impressed that Dave Gardy came to work for Washington. Now, what will his role be here? Well, first, let me just mention, this is a football side of the building hire, it would appear to me. This is somebody that is going to be, you know, reporting to, more likely than not, the general manager, the owner, probably the general manager, I'm guessing. But the job description in the press release reads as follows. Gardy will handle a number of in-game management duties and will support the coaching staff and front office on compliance with league protocols, officiating trends, and health and safety guidelines. So a couple of people in our beat reported on this. Ben Standig, our Washington Commanders insider, tweeted out yesterday about the hiring of Gardy. He wrote, where is it? I had it here a second ago. Gardy will handle a number of in-game management duties and will support the coaching staff and front office on compliance with league protocols, officiating trends, and health and safety guidelines. Nikki Javala wrote the following about his responsibilities. She wrote that Gardy is expected to be on the headset during games. His emphasis in season will be on the coaching side. So Dave Gardy has a football background. His father was the head coach at Hofstra University for many years. And apparently he is a sharp football mind. But in the league office, when you're working in the league office, it's not like you're a part of the action on Sundays for a particular team. When Nikki wrote he'll be on the headset, to me, that means there's a possibility he's one of those guys that's advising Dan Quinn on things like when to throw the challenge flag, when to go for two, when to go for fourth downs. Washington's had a guy like that in recent years on the headset with Ron Rivera. And I'm wondering if that's kind of why, you know, Gardy decided he wanted out of the league office. Maybe he thinks, and maybe people know, that this is something he'd be really good at. Now, I don't know that that's going to be his specific responsibility, being on the headset. It could be something as easy as, look, you know, health and safety. I see, you know, a player that's banged up in, I see it before the officials in the booth see it. You got to pull the player out. Or, I don't know, some sort of rules interpretation that, you know, Quinn might need help with during a game. I don't know. I guess we'll find out. But Dan Quinn said about Dave Gardy, he's one of the brightest minds in our league when it comes to football operations. He will be an incredible resource to the coaching staff as we prepare and plan for game days. Dave brings a unique perspective to our organization after working with the league office for two decades. His addition makes our organization better across the board. I'm thrilled to welcome Dave and his family to D.C. I mentioned Gardy. His father was the head coach of Hofstra for many years. Gardy actually went to Brown in the Ivy League and played quarterback there for 4 years. Got a B.A. in political science at Brown, and then also earned a law degree, from Hofstra University. Hofstra's out on Long Island. So apparently a very impressive hire. You know, it made me think of yesterday when I saw this. Remember the hiring of Brian LaFemina? You know, Brian came in as, you know, did he have the team president? I think Brian did have the team president title. Didn't he? Or was it chief operating officer? I think he was a COO. I don't think he was actually the team president. But when he took that job, you know, reporting to Dan and to Bruce, there were a lot of people that thought, you know, the league pushed Brian LaFemina on the organization because it had become such a train wreck. They needed somebody like LaFemina to get involved, to help Dan, to help Bruce, two helpless people in the running of an NFL franchise. Tommy said, I'll never forget it, the day after the hire on the show, he said, my advice for Brian LaFemina, rent, don't buy, and predicted that it wouldn't last a year. And it didn't. He lasted 7 months on the job. And, you know, part of it was LaFemina was a bit of a bull in a china shop. He came in and he just told the truth. And that was not, that was frowned upon. I mean, we weren't supposed to discuss the waiting list not existing. The season ticket waiting list not existing. They did not want to hear him admit that, hey, we have tickets available. I remember the discussions about Brian LaFemina, and some of us had a chance to meet with him. I went out and spent an hour with him one day at the park, and he was just interested in finding out what people who had been in the market had been, you know, a part of covering the team or part of the broadcast or whatever, thought about various things, and he said, I'll never forget the line, because they were not very happy that he admitted that they had tickets to sell for the upcoming season. They said, that's not what we do around here. We create the perception of kind of a very hard ticket to get. And he said, I'll never forget, he said, I didn't really understand it. I thought that if we actually had tickets to sell, we should tell people that we have tickets to sell. And I said, seems pretty logical to me. And I remember telling him, this waiting list, they may think that people are still buying it, but people haven't bought it for at least 5, if not 10 years. I mean, you don't turn on the TV and see yellow throughout the club level and orange up top, empty seats, and think that there's a massive waiting list. But that was really funny. I'll just never forget. I thought that if we had tickets available, we should tell people that it might be a better thing in our effort to sell more tickets. 7 months he lasted in that job. I have a feeling he couldn't wait to get out of here as much as they couldn't wait to boot him out of here. But I don't think that's exactly the Gardy job that he has taken. Brian LaFemina was involved in a lot of different things. And I think in so many ways it was almost like Dan just allowing the league to try to help, even though he had no intention of letting him help. But it had gotten to the point where Goodell and others are like, this thing is such a mess. Can we send somebody down there? Will you hire this guy and let him help you? But they didn't. So I'm going to get back to that story that Jeremy Fowler wrote about, that had a lot of quotes from league execs, league front office execs on the quarterbacks. But Warren Sharp did his schedule, not mock schedule, but did his strength of schedule forecast for the upcoming season. And if you, you know, look at various strength of schedule forecasts for teams in the NFL, a lot of times it's based on last year's records. It's not the way Warren Sharp does it. He does it based on what the teams are projected to be moving forward. Now, it's early to project what these teams are going to be moving forward this year because we haven't even had a draft. And there will probably be at least two teams, if not three or four, that may be starting a rookie quarterback that could change the calculus for what people think of the teams. But he went through the process anyway, you know, essentially looking at teams' current over-under forecast, meaning evaluating what their projected strength will be in the upcoming season rather than last year's closing record. And he came up with the easiest schedules, toughest schedules, and a ranking of the schedules. And by far and away, the Atlanta Falcons have the easiest schedule in 2024. Now, two teams in the NFC South are in the top five, and the other two are in the top 11. The NFC South, because you play each team in the division twice, it was the worst division last year. It's projected to be the worst division again this upcoming year. So all four of those teams have comparable schedules, but the Falcons have the easiest based on two totally different games than the other two. The Chargers have the second easiest schedule in the league. The Bears, the third. The Jets, the fourth. And the Saints, the fifth easiest schedules, according to Warren Sharp. Again, based on projecting what the teams are supposed to be, not what they were last year. And remember, everybody knows their opponents, right? I think most of you know that. The schedule's not out in terms of the dates and the times, but we all know who everybody plays and where, home or away. We know that as it relates to every team in the league. I think most of you know that. Like, Washington's opponents in 2024 are the division teams, home and away. And then in addition to that, they play Atlanta, Carolina, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Tennessee, and Chicago at home. New Orleans, Tampa, Baltimore, Arizona, and Cincinnati on the road. So where is Washington's strength of schedule? 13th in the league. 13th toughest. So top half of the league, easiest schedules this year. The Eagles do have an easier schedule, according to Warren Sharp, in terms of teams in the division. The Giants and Cowboys with tougher schedules. The toughest schedule in the league, according to Warren Sharp, Pittsburgh, with the toughest, followed by New England, Cleveland, Baltimore, and Minnesota. So there you go. Schedule talk here in April. By the way, a month from today is probably the day, it could be a week earlier, but typically the second week in May now is the schedule release day. And I have decided that I will do the mock draft again this year. Try to match my performance last year where I predicted the first game would be against the Arizona Cardinals. All right, so I wanted to get back to this story that Jeremy Fowler wrote, which had some really good stuff on the quarterbacks in the draft, ranked them by tiers, and had many different team execs rank, you know, with quotes and insight on the quarterbacks from an NFL front office standpoint. I talked about Caleb Williams and Drake May and Jaden Daniels, but there was some very interesting stuff said about J.J. McCarthy. I'll get to that when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show. The Team 980, theteam980.com. We are also free and live on the Odyssey app. I want to tell you about Window Nation. Window Nation right now has a great deal going on for April, for springtime weather. It's important to have quality windows for that. You want to open up your windows to let in fresh air. You don't want them to close or slide down. And at night, you probably want to seal them to keep the pollen out if you've got allergies. Window Nation is the expert. They are the experts at all of this. And right now, you can get two windows free with every two you purchase with no limits. So you will save big by paying half price no matter how many windows you purchase. In addition to that, no interest and no payments for 24 months. Window Nation's windows come with a lifetime warranty. They can be installed in a day or less. And with proven quality and service, when you buy from Window Nation, you can rest assured you're getting affordable windows that meet or beat the ones from the national brand names. Don't miss out on your chance to afford quality windows with an unlimited buy two, get two free, plus zero interest, zero payments for two full years. You can't afford to wait. Call now, 866-90-NATION. That's 866-90-NATION. Or go to windownation.com. Mention my name for a free, no obligation in-home estimate.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So I was reading from this Jeremy Fowler story, which I found interesting. More draft discussion, more quarterbacks, but looking for some quotes from credible people. He's got a bunch of senior NFL execs. He's got a lot of scouts that are quoted as they were asked by Jeremy to rank the quarterbacks in the draft by tiers, to give the quarterbacks sort of pro comps and to weigh in on the quarterbacks. And I shared with you a little bit earlier in the show what they said about Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, and Drake May. And there was some stuff on J.J. McCarthy that I wanted to get to because, you know, it starts with this from Fowler. McCarthy, you know, based on all of the football execs and scouts, is easily the most fascinating and most polarizing of the quarterback prospects in the draft. Evaluators are truly all over the map. Some see elite talent, maybe the best long-term play of the group, while others see fringe first-round or even second-round talent. This is a quote from an NFC exec. I don't see him getting past five or six. Definitely not getting out of the top 10. Anticipation, decision-making, preparation. Coming from pro-style offense, he's got a lot going for him. You see him process, go through progressions. That's an easier predictor of what it would look like at the NFL level. Another high-ranking NFL official on McCarthy. I'm buying the hype that he goes high. He's got something to him from a leadership and makeup standpoint that resonates. McCarthy gets the game manager label, having averaged 22.6 passing attempts per game over the past two seasons. The lack of in-game volume only heightened the scrutiny around McCarthy's pro day, where McCarthy validated some things with one of the best pro days I've ever seen as a passer, according to one veteran NFL personnel evaluator. This from a scout, an NFL scout. Movement ability, arm talent, laying the football. I think he means layering the football. Throwing off platform. He did it all at his pro day. McCarthy wasn't a game manager because they had something to hide. He has high-level traits. It's more a function of Jim Harbaugh's offense. He's never been asked to throw 30-plus times a game, but I think he can handle it. An AFC offensive coach. This is an AFC offensive coach. Harbaugh didn't trust him like he did Andrew Luck. When he makes a mistake, Harbaugh leans into the running game even more so during the flow of the game. And then we got to more of sort of the negative thought or the critical thought about McCarthy. This is an AFC scout who said, quote, "I just don't see it. I don't see consistent accuracy, his ability to get it done inside the white lines, and the Michigan staff didn't call games or play offensively like they trusted him. But one reason he's rising, what you're seeing now is the coaches and coordinators are more involved in the draft process, and they are realizing S, as in expletive S, he's a pro already. And he showed more arm strength at his pro day than I thought he had," closed quote. I think the comment about the Michigan staff didn't call games or play offensively like they trusted him, no matter how good Michigan was as an offensive rushing football team, dominant up front. Cooley, you know, shared with us the other day in his film breakdown of McCarthy, he said, they ran more 7 and 8 man protections than you'll ever see at the college level. So it's really hard to gauge, you know, what's going on there when he was asked to throw from more times than not a clean pocket. And if it wasn't, he had to get outside and create, because when you've got 8 man protections and there is pressure, it gets very, you know, busy in front of you. But he essentially said he just wasn't asked to do enough to be able to evaluate enough. And you can look at Michigan. You can look at what they did and how much more they ran the football this past season. And I'm looking it up right now. I think it's like 200 more pass attempts than rushing attempts this year. So he had 361 passing attempts. There were 563 rushing attempts. So 202 more rush attempts than passing attempts. But one of the reasons was they were a dominant rush offense. Blake Corum ran for nearly 5 yards a carry. Donovan Edwards, 4.2 yards per carry. They just were a physical wear-you-down team. And then defensively, they were so good, they just had massive leads in games where they didn't have to play catch-up at any point this year. You know, most of their games were over at halftime. The first competitive game of the season for them didn't come until the second weekend in November, and that was the game against Penn State. They were up 14-9 at halftime. They didn't throw a pass in the second half of the game. I know many of you know that about the Michigan-Penn State game in Happy Valley this year. J.J. McCarthy was 7 of 8 for 60 yards without a pass attempt in the second half of the game. Corum ran for 145. They rushed as a team for 227 yards. But the real issue was that Penn State was impotent offensively. They couldn't do anything. The only way they were going to win the game was if Michigan imploded. And they did not put J.J. McCarthy or anybody on that team into a position of imploding. They were totally fine punting the football, which they did 6 times in that game. And that's where you look at it and you say, could they have blown Penn State out if they had let McCarthy throw it a little bit more? Could they? I mean, in the game, they were less than 500 on third down efficiency. It didn't matter to them because Penn State couldn't move the football. So we're fine on 3rd and 7 running the football and punting. Does that say more about lack of trust in McCarthy? Or does it say, look, the game situation means we don't have to use McCarthy? That was the first game all year that they had, Michigan did, that was a competitive football game. Now, it got different towards the end. They played Maryland in a very close game. You know, Maryland picked off J.J. McCarthy in the game and defensively had their best day of the year. Maryland was not a good defensive team for much of the year. Maryland was in the game against the eventual national champion. The score, you know, into the fourth quarter was a one-score game. It was 29-24 entering the fourth quarter. They had the ball multiple times down 29-24, then had the ball down after a safety a couple of times down 31-24. You know what Michigan did to salt the game away? Nothing. They punted on their last three drives with a five-point lead and a seven-point lead. McCarthy got sacked a couple of times, threw a pick in that game. You know, they didn't put it on his, you know, they're in a competitive game at Maryland. You know, was it truly losable? Yeah, it actually was if you were watching the game. McCarthy was 12 of 23 for 141 yards with a pick and no touchdowns. Then they played Ohio State the next week. And, you know, there was the thought that the reason the game against Maryland was so competitive in College Park was they were looking ahead to the Ohio State game in Ann Arbor, in the Big House. This was another game that was tight throughout. You know, it was a seven-point game entering the fourth quarter. It was a three-point game with, you know, midway through the fourth quarter. They really didn't put it on J.J. McCarthy. Now, he had an outstanding game. But he only threw it 20 times. They still ran it 39-21. Why? Well, they were successful running it. McCarthy was 16 for 20 in that game, though. And they had some big-time plays. But they struggled, you know, at times down the stretch. Not down the stretch. In the first half, they punted a bunch in that game. They were 3 for 12 on third down in that game. And then they blew out Iowa. Iowa couldn't score in the Big Ten title game. And then, you know, you got to the playoffs, and I thought McCarthy did a really good job against Alabama. I think that's the game in which you take away that opening drive where he threw a pick on his first throw. The ball was thrown to the sideline. He got picked off, but the receiver's heel was on the sideline, so it was ruled incomplete. It was a terrible throw to open up that game. But, you know, that game was phenomenal. You know, he drove them down that field, down 20-13 in the fourth quarter to tie it on an 8-play, 75-yard drive. Yeah, there was a lot of running on that drive, you know, including McCarthy, who had a big run on that drive. But he had a big completion to Corum out of the backfield on 4th-and-2. Remember that 4th-and-2 play to keep him alive in the game, and then had a big throw to Roman Wilson, who was a projected, you know, day two or day three pick. Day two, more likely than not. And McCarthy came up big in that game. There's no doubt. It's still not massive numbers, but 17-27, 221 yards, three touchdowns. And then, look, the national championship was a one-sided beatdown, you know, against Washington. And he didn't have to do a whole lot through the air, and they didn't ask him to do much. He was 10 of 18 for 140 yards. Corum went for a buck 35 or something like that. Donovan Edwards had that big run. They each had four touchdowns combined on the ground. They rushed for over 300 yards. Washington couldn't get them off the field. And Michigan's defense dominated. But I do think it is interesting, the idea that, you know, were they holding them back because they were afraid? Or were they just holding him back at times because they really didn't need him? I think it's more the latter, which still creates the mystery of what can he do. The Alabama game was big for him. That last drive to force overtime was a big, big moment for J.J. McCarthy, no doubt. Not to say that the intangibles weren't going to jump off, you know, for everybody once we got to that point. But he needed the national championship win, and he needed that game against a really good defense in Alabama's defense in a close game, you know, to take, you know, if you want to compare, because both J.J. McCarthy and Jaden Daniels played Alabama. J.J. McCarthy played the entire game. It went to overtime. He was 17 of 27 for 221 yards, 3 touchdowns, and had a clutch drive at the end of that game to force overtime. And made a big run on that drive and had some big throws on that drive as well. Jaden Daniels, I can tell you, was sensational against Alabama. He got hurt in the second half on a hit by, the first round pick Dallas Turner, the expected first round high pick Dallas Turner. But before he left the game, midway through the third quarter, he had thrown for 219 and 2 touchdowns, and he had rushed for 163 yards. So he had nearly 400 yards himself of offense against that Alabama defense on the road, by the way, not neutral field, on the road in Tuscaloosa. And the score was 28-21 or 35-28, something like that, when he left the game. Anyway. All right, up next, Lance Zierlein, longtime NFL draft expert, will be our guest. Chase Hughes will join us from Monumental next hour. We'll talk some NBA playoffs, and what will the Wizards do with Brian Keefe, their head coach? Are they going to keep him or not? That's next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.